10 weeks. Yeah, 10 weeks. It's kind of been over the northern tribe. We're gonna go down to Judah, where most of the time kings are doing bad, but every once in a while you get a good one. As opposed to, it was pretty dark and dreary in the rest of Israel for a long, long time. And we're gonna go back into Judah and follow kind of the lineage the same way we did of the northern tribe. We're gonna do that for Judah. And so we're starting out with Joash, which is, you're gonna hear some names that you remember. Might have to think back a little while, but you're gonna hear names that you remember. Ahab is a name that should be ringing, not the good bells, but the bad bells. And so we're kind of following in this line. And what we're going to see throughout the whole of this is how well God protected the line Christ was going to come through. So this is a story of that. We read often in Scripture, family turning against each other, trying to usurp the throne. And this is another story along those same lines. You see how twisted, incredibly twisted it gets when you start to add power into the mix, even amongst family. This is a gruesome story that God prevails through, prevails in line. This is going to be one of the pegs on Christ's lineage is going to be Joash, because all of his siblings were killed by a family member who usurps the throne and holds it for a brief moment. And so we see this happen over and over. It was incredibly interesting to me is throughout this whole thing, and we see it, the phrase, Prince of my people, often when we're talking about David, Solomon, and Saul. When God comes down and anoints a king, he doesn't say, hey, you're to be the king over the people. He says, hey, I've chosen you to be prince over my people. And the kings that do well often repeat that. That they know whose authority they're under still. And when that gets erased, guess what happens? All hell breaks loose, right? You just see people squabbling over what I would consider a false throne. A head. And because they sit on a throne, we're going to read about a priest in this that his name is Jehoiada, and if I'm pronouncing that, it's got three vowels in a row, and I struggle with that one. J-E-H-O-I-A-D-A, Jehoiada, is what I'm going with. I think that's right. That's how my little audio book pronounced it, but I'm not going to say that they're always right either, but sometimes it's good to listen to them as well. In this reign of Joash, Jehoiada is this constant figure. He's a priest. He's of the Levite lineage. He's related to Joash, and he's bringing up his nephew in the ways of God. And what we see is we see it all fall apart here shortly. It doesn't take long. But I also want to point out the fact that Joash took the throne when he was 7. I don't know many 7-year-olds, but there's not many, right? You kind of think through your head right now. When I was 7, that would have been a nightmare. That shaking said, yeah. I already can tell you when Brooks is 7, it's going to be a nightmare. So this isn't something that was probably the, I mean, it's again, God taking somebody out of where you can only give credit due to God through his whole story. And we're going to skip over it because I tend to get a little bit long-winded. We're starting in 23. The story really starts in chapter 22, if y'all want to go back. But Jehoiada's grandma, Athalia, is killing everybody. All of his family line. Why? Because she wants to usurp the throne. And she does just that. And Jehoiada hides Joash in the house of God for years until they hatch this plan that we're about to read. But through this whole thing, I want us to recognize and hopefully overlay this with what we tend to do in our own lives, maybe to what seems to be a less substantial extent. But how many things do we squabble over our plans versus God's plans? And God's plans has a way of working itself out. Our plans oftentimes go get in the way if we're looking for ourselves. And that's what you see. You see all these people squabbling over a throne that doesn't even, that's not even there to put somebody in power. I mean, that's what the people intended for. But this is God's people who God reigns over and who God has complete control over. And when things aren't going well, what does God tend to do? Put them back in slavery. Put them back into being ruled over by a different people. And so you have this small time where you might feel like the kingpin, and then it all comes crumbling down. Because God's plan works out in the end every single time. And so we're going to talk about Joash a little bit. Keep that in mind. Keep this lineage in mind of God protecting the promises that he's made. I have a few thoughts on that, but we'll see if we get to them because they're kind of a rabbit hole, a little off topic. So 2 Chronicles chapter 23. But in the seventh year, Jehoiada took courage and entered into a covenant with the commanders of hundreds, Azariah the son of Jerome, Ishmael the son of Jehohanan, Azariah the son of Obed, Messiah, Maaseiah the son of Adai, Elishaphat the son of Zichri, and they went about through Judah and gathered the Levites from all the cities of Judah and the heads of the fathers of Israel, of the fathers' houses of Israel. And they came to Jerusalem, and all the assembly made a covenant with the king in the house of God. And Jehoiada said to them, "Behold, the king's son, let him reign, as the Lord spoke concerning the sons of David. This is the thing that you shall do. O you priests and Levites who come off duty on the Sabbath, one-third shall be gatekeepers, and one-third shall be at the king's house, and one-third at the gate of the foundation. And all the people shall be in the courts of the house of the Lord. Let no one enter the house of the Lord except the priests and the ministering Levites. They may enter, for they are holy, but all the people shall keep the charge of the Lord. The Levites shall surround the king, each with his weapon in his hand, and whoever enters the house shall be put to death. Be with the king when he comes in and when he goes out." The Levites and all Judah did according to all that Jehoiada the priest commanded. And they each brought his men who were to go off duty on the Sabbath, with those who were to come on duty on the Sabbath. For Jehoiada the priest did not dismiss the divisions, and Jehoiada the priest gave to the captains the spears and the large and the small shields that had been King David's, which were in the house of God. And he set all the people as a guard for the king, every man with his weapon in his hand, from the south side of the house to the north side of the house. around the altar in the house. Then they brought out the king's son and put the crown on him and gave him the testimony. Testimony is going to be the law. And they proclaimed him king, and Jehoiada and his sons anointed him, and they said, long live the king. So a couple things. We're going from this godless era where there's a usurper of the throne and she kills everybody, into what a priest is putting Joash on the throne. And so what's he do initially? I think this is important that sometimes we miss. In Deuteronomy, it talks about the king having his own scroll of the law so that he could read it and know it, so that he knows how to guide God's people. So what do? They anoint him with the scroll in hand. It's important. We're starting this thing off in the right direction. And we see this throughout Jehoiada's mentorship of him. And then we see Jehoiada pass away and this all go out the window because he starts listening to people that he shouldn't. But in the inception of this, Jehoiada is setting it up how God deems it should be. When Athaliah heard the noise of the people running and praising the king, she went into the house of the Lord to the people, and when she looked, there was the king standing by his pillar at the entrance, and the captains and the trumpeters beside the king, and all the people of the land rejoicing and blowing trumpets, and the singers with their musical instruments, leading in the celebration. And Athaliah tore her clothes and cried, "Treason, treason!" Then Jehoiada the priest brought out the captains who were set over the army, saying to them, "Bring her out between the ranks, and anyone who follows her is to be put to death with the sword. For the priest said, 'Do not put her to death in the house of the Lord.'" Important, do not put her to death in the house of the Lord. I also want to point out, she's calling treason after what? She put to death all but Joash in the line that was meant to be in line for the kingship. So they laid hands on her, and she went into the entrance of the horse gate of the king's house, and they put her to death there. And Jehoiada made a covenant between himself and all the people and the king that they should be the Lord's people. Then all the people went to the house of Baal and tore it down, his altars and his images. They broke in pieces, and they killed Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altars. And Jehoiada posted watchmen for the house of the Lord under the direction of the Levitical priests and the Levites, whom David had organized to be in charge of the house of the Lord, to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, as it is written in the law of Moses, with rejoicing and singing according to the order of David. He stationed the gatekeepers at the gates of the house of the Lord, so that no one should enter who was in any way unclean. And he took the captains, the nobles, the governors of the people, and all the people of the land, and they brought the king down from the house of the Lord, marching through the upper gates to the king's house. And they set the king on the royal throne. So all the people of the land rejoiced, and the city was quiet after Athaliah had been put to death with the sword. Joash was 7 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba, and Joash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest. Jehoiada got for him two wives, and he had sons and daughters. After Joash decided to restore the house of the Lord, and he gathered the priests and the Levites and said to them, "Go out to the cities of Judah and gather from all Israel money to repair the house of the Lord of your God. But from year to year of your God, from year to year, and see that you act quickly." But the Levites did not act quickly. So the king summoned Jehoiada, the chief, and said to him, "Why have you not required the Levites to bring in from Judah and Jerusalem the tax levied by Moses, the servant of the Lord and the congregation of Israel, for all the tenth of testimony for the sons of Athaliah, that wicked woman had broken into the house of God and had also used all the dedicated friends who went. This is Joash bringing Jehoiakim. What's that? Yes. Sorry, mispronunciation there. But he's bringing the guy who put him on the throne into his area and saying, hey, why haven't you been doing this? That's the action of a king to a mentor. So you see in this that Joash is actually stepping into this role and he's doing as God says. And so we see this out of a king, not just always under the thumb and always just taking in, but he's acting as a king in this moment. And he's saying, hey, why haven't you done what I commanded you to do? And we're about to see the people, which nobody's typically excited about taxes, right? But the people are about to actually give all the taxes that Moses commanded. And through this whole moment, what is Joash doing? He's restoring things to how God meant them to be. Through everything. He's following the law through the whole nine yards. He's restoring the temple. He's trying to fix the temple. Why? Because that the previous, his grandma that slayed everybody and all of her, the wicked woman, had broken into the house of God and had also used all the dedicated things in the house of the Lord for the Baals. And so we see him start to restore everything, bring everything back into what it should be. So the king commanded, and they made a chest and set it outside the gate of the house of the Lord, and proclamation was made throughout Judah and Jerusalem to bring in for the Lord the tax that Moses, the servant of God, laid on Israel in the wilderness. And all the princes and all the people rejoiced and brought their tax and dropped it into the chest until they had finished. All the people rejoiced and brought their tax and dropped into the chest until they had finished. And whenever the chest was brought to the king's officers by the Levites, when they saw that there was much money in it, the king's secretary and officer of the chief priest would come and empty the chest and take it and return it to its place. Thus they did day after day and collected money in abundance. And the king and Jehoiada gave it to those who had charge of the work of the house of the Lord, and they hired masons and carpenters to restore the house of the Lord, and also workers in iron and bronze to repair the house of the Lord. So those who were engaged in the work labored, and the repairing went forward in their hands, and they restored the house of God to its proper condition and strength. And when they had finished, they brought to the rest of the money before the king and Jehoiada, and with it were made utensils for the house of the Lord, both for the services and for the burnt offerings, and dishes for incense, and vessels of gold and silver. And they offered burnt offerings in the house of the Lord regularly all the days of who? Jehoiada. But Jehoiada grew old and full of days and died. He was 130 years old at his death, and they buried him in the city of David among the kings, because he had done good in Israel and toward God and his house. Now after the death of Jehoiada, the princes of Judah came and paid homage to the king. Then the king listened to them, and they abandoned the house of the Lord, for God of the God of their fathers, and served the Asherim and the idols, and wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this guilt of theirs. Yet he sent prophets among them to bring them back to the Lord. These testify against them, but they would not pay attention. I'm going to read one more thing, and then we'll talk a little bit more. Then the Spirit of God clothed Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, the priest, and he stood above the people and said to them, thus says God, why do you break the commandments of the Lord so that you cannot prosper? Because you have forsaken the Lord, he has forsaken you, but they conspired against him and by command of the king, they stoned him with the stones in the court of the house of the Lord. Thus Joash the king did not remember the kindness that Jehoiada, Zechariah's father, had shown him, but killed his son. And when he was dying, he said, "May the Lord see and avenge." Cool. The man that put him on the throne, his son calls him out for what? Turning his back on everything that he had done. Because his sons wanted to be rebellious and he listened to the princes of Judah, and out of that he was turned, starts following right back to where they were. I mean, crazy. In his one life, and when he gets called out, what's his reaction?
Anger.
And where they wouldn't even kill the usurper queen, the wicked woman, as the Bible puts it. They took him outside the house of the Lord to do it, right? Out of reverence for God. But what does the king, who spent out of 40 years of his reign, it doesn't say exactly, but probably close to half of them, walking in the way of God and doing the things that God asked him to do and restoring God's house, what does he do? He has him stoned in the house of the Lord. Wow. That's a complete 180 degree turn. And what we see over and over and over and over is a king that starts to do good and then turns away. Starts to do this. They're probably enjoying success right now, right? There's riches that are being thrown around, and after they get done with the house of the Lord, they're still collecting this tax, but you can probably see that starts to turn away from what God intended and into what? Using God's law, God's people's money, to build idols and do all this stuff for the house of Baal. Whoa. It's like we're repeating the golden calf story over and over and over and over and over. Right? What is deemed to be treacherous amongst generations, that it biblically says generations will suffer for the golden calf story. We do it over and over and over and over. It's mind-boggling, but what it keeps bringing me back to is we may not be building these idols or doing these. I mean, we're doing cultural equivalents often. Who likes a TV show that just binge watch? Who likes all this stuff that just sucks them away completely? I was listening to something that one of the guys at work sent me. And it depicts this gruesome act of what a couple doing something in front of the church and how disgusted we would be by that. And then we go home and we watch the same thing on our TVs. It's like, hey, we kind of missing it, I think, probably. If we're going and laughing at stuff on the TV that we would be disgusted by somebody doing in front of us in the church building. And we just see this turn of this person that was doing everything right. And who gets buried with the kings? And we're going to skip this part, but in the end, Joash's own people kill him. He gets wounded in a battle that is very opposite of what we hear. Joash has a big army, and the Assyrians have a small army. And guess who God gives victory to? The small army. As he does frequently with his own people. Joash has this massive army, and you're thinking, oh man, And probably anybody's at that time is thinking, oh, Israel's just going to squash them. Like, if this was being played on Sunday at NFL, we'd be like, yeah, this is the Cleveland Browns versus whoever else is in the NFL, right? It's just this David and Goliath story. Well, I guess Cleveland wins some. Yeah. I don't know who the worst team is anymore. Probably the Giants or something. I don't know. When Cleveland never won a game for like 4 years, that was them. And you're thinking, oh man, they're about to get squashed. And God gives this giant army into the hands of a small army. And Joash's own men, after he's wounded in battle, kill him in bed. And he gets buried in dishonor. And your books will go over that. It doesn't get buried with the kings. He goes from this guy who restored things back to how it should be, to let them fall all apart, to being in this spot where, man, he's not even, they're not even honoring him in death. Things must have got really twisted not to even honor him in death. Because guess what David did for Saul? Right? That guy got twisted off pretty well. But even Saul, David honors in a poem and buries him and tells people not to touch him when they get the opportunity, when it feels like God has presented Saul into David's hands, and David says, I don't have the authority to stretch out my hand against God's anointed. And his own guys have been like, but, I mean, you kind of led him right to you. The guy that pursued his own life gets buried in a vastly different manner. And so we see this beautiful start to Joash's reign. And then we see Jehoiada get buried in the place of kings because he had the respect from the people. And then what happens is Joash's sons start to turn him back against him. He's like, well, and you can almost just see this generational. I hate talking about politics, but we're going to talk about it for a second because it, I believe, vastly mirrors just the human condition. Is we have these ginormous pendulum swings. It doesn't stay here in the middle. We have this extreme one way, extreme the other way. And America tends to do it 4 to 8 years. Right? They get fed up with whatever. It doesn't matter the circumstance. They get fed up with it. You see that in Israel's walk, is whether it's going great or whether it's going terrible. Eventually, people get fed up with what's happening. And they want to do their own thing. And so you see, even in times where things are flourishing and doing great, the pendulum's going to swing back. And then it's going to put you in a terrible place. And then people are going to get fed up with that place where they don't feel like anything's getting done, and they're frustrated with the system. They're frustrated with oppression. And so they're going to go and right the wrong. And then the pendulum in. Guys, we kind of make fun of this, but Joash's reign was 40 years. We did it like every four. If that's not mind-boggling enough to show you the human condition of how short-term people's memories are, it is mind-boggling. And you see that here, and you probably see it in your own life, and you probably have these micro swings in your own life, or maybe you're having big swings in your own life, but we can probably see that happen. When things are going really well, or whatever the case may be, we kind of turn around and go, hey, I'm doing pretty good right now. I might be doing well at work, I might have got a promotion, I might have done this, or raise, or whatever the case may be, and I'm doing pretty well right now. What does that have in the sentence that it shouldn't have? I. What should it have? Hey, God, thank you for this opportunity. Hey, Lord. And I'm not saying that that's going to keep you. I'm not preaching prosperity gospel up here. I'm not saying that's going to keep bad things from happening. But I'm going to say that's our mindset towards what we should be doing is no matter good or bad, we should be saying, hey, thank you, God. And a bad, we should be saying, hey, God, thanks for what I have, what you've given me. Thanks for this opportunity. older. This is an experience that's going to help you help people. This is going to be an experience that's going to help you with people on the outside looking in that might need just what you have to say. This is going to be, I mean, it's not going to be roses. There's some younger people, but this isn't just necessarily the youngest crowd. We've probably all been through some stuff we don't want to be through. And it's probably not over. Right? And so we look at all of that and we condense it into, we see just this human condition of what people do all the time, swing back and forth. And typically, if we're going to talk about it normally, in the good times, we swing to, hey, I'm doing well. And in the bad times, we swing to, hey, Lord, come on. Right? We like to play the blame game. And when it's going good, we like to blame ourselves because every once in a while we like to do this. When at the end of the day, in every one of our lives, what should our goal be? Serve God. Not necessarily the raise, not necessarily the promotion, not necessarily the success, or whatever else the vice is in our life. The momentary fleshly desires, not whatever else we can put in that hole. Because right now, culture is saying there's a lot of wicked stuff that's good. That's what they tell us all the time. Churches with large followings are preaching wicked stuff is good. Ooh. That should send a shiver down our spine that you can just go on the internet and find anybody preaching about almost anything saying that it's okay. Ooh. What we're here to be, our daily aspiration, and that's what I think we always can boil all this down and just pack it in to say, man, if you focus on God and your focus is upward throughout your day, you're going to be amazed. Not necessarily that everything's just going to go peachy, right? But your mindset through things that are going bad allows you to handle a lot more than you would probably think you could. Allows you to turn into the reflection that you're meant to be so that when outside people are looking in, what do they see? Christ. What we're intended for. Because what is not attractive and what Christianity, it's like a used car dealer. Nobody likes used car dealers, right? We're all shady, apparently. But when you have a conversation with somebody, you're already pigeonholed. And what Christianity is pigeonholed into is hypocrisy and judgment. That's what people view us as. Man, then why did Christ attract so many sinners and wretched? Why was it the Pharisees that were bothered by Christ's walk in life? Why was it the righteous that got so nuts up with who Christ was and claimed to be? You ever thought about that? I wonder why. It's because he came for the sick, not to push the sick away. But you see this, and I love the chosen in lots of different ways, but you see this recognition when people see Christ and speak to Christ, where it's they just repeatedly in that show they say, hey, something's different. When Christ is calling the disciples, have y'all ever thought about how odd it was to up and leave everything there must have been something vastly different, because if I'm thinking right now, if people are to stage a coup in other governments or even here to lead something, who are we going to look to? Probably someone who's got some recognition already. This is a guy that was trying to lay low for a long time. Right? When he's going doing his first miracles, he's saying, hey, just don't tell anybody about it. When his mom comes to ask him to turn water into wine, he's like, hey, it's not my time, but for you. And we just see this buildup of not self-proclaimed, not anything, but just people who follow him because he's different. Now, we're not going to live up to that wholly, right? But when people see us, they should be seeing something different. One of the bad things that are happening to Christ is he throwing tantrums? Is he doing all the stuff that we usually do? Or is there a peace about it? Is there something that you just say, that's innately not of flesh? That's what we're invited into. There's a peace about it. There's something different that when we are reflecting Christ well, I wholeheartedly believe that people recognize it. And they're drawn to that. Probably the best place I was ever at in my life, even counting today, was at CMU. Which seems weird because it was a very not great place. The football team was crude environment, as you can probably imagine. You know how many times I got asked why I did something a certain way? Pretty often. Because I'm in an environment around a lot of people who might not have, they've probably heard of God, granted, but they've never watched somebody reflect. And I'm not perfect at it. I'm not claiming to be. And that's why I'm saying, hey, however many years ago that was probably the best place I was at. Because I got hit hard with, the Spirit saying, you're being quite the knucklehead. And you need to snap out of it. And that was rocking to me. To my core in that moment, and probably a great moment to have it in. And when you just see these people walking about life with a joy that is just, that's not, you should, why are you happy? Don't you know what's happening? Don't you know the world's on fire?
Yeah.
And you see somebody walking around with that, that strikes a chord with lot of people. Because it's different. It's easy to look like the rest of the world. Shoot, we probably do it daily, right? Probably have these instances where you're talking to somebody, you get frustrated with somebody, you get frustrated with the situation, and you do something that is very unchristlike. And to everybody looking in, they're like, yeah, it's just another. Another one of me, and that's where you start to get the hypocrisy. And we're not ever going to perfect it, but I think in the Sermon on the Mount, are you done with that, or are you done? We're done with the Sermon on the Mount, but I think throughout Kevin's preaching on it, he really hit the nail on the head saying, did he really say that? Did he really call me to that standard? Because we, even in our own lives, do what the rest of the world does. But you hear these preachers saying that all this sin is very evident in the Bible. Sin. preaches that it's okay. We do that on a micro scale in our own lives, don't we? Well, God didn't really expect me to be perfect, did he? Well. And the Sermon on the Mount's flipping all that on its head, saying, well, you're called to reflect Christ, which was perfection. And there's grace extended, right? But, I mean, we see that's not supposed to be used as just your hall pass. Whenever you feel like, hey, I'm frustrated, I feel like it's justified for me to lash out in this moment.